The king leaned back in his stone seat.
I will not give him back. The queen will see reason. It will take some time for the Black Volume to work its will upon Ash. But when it has, we will no longer need the portal. He will be able to spread the blight and destruction with his very hands. The queen hates shadow hunters as much as I do. Within a month, their precious land of Idris will look like this.
He gestured at the window set in the wall. Suddenly, the view through the glass changed. In fact, there was no glass. It was as if a hole had been torn in the world, and through it Emma could see a view of a blowing desert and a gray sky scorched with lightning. The sand was stained red with blood, and broken trees stood scarecrow-like against the acidic horizon.
That's not our world, Julian murmured. It's another dimension, like Edom. But Edom was destroyed.
Emma couldn't stop staring. Human figures, half covered by the sand, the white of bone.
Julian, I can see bodies.
The king waved his hand again and the portal turned dark.
As Thule is now, so Idris will be.
Thule? The word was familiar. Emma frowned.
You think you'll be able to convince the queen to endanger her child just for power, said Annabel. Not everyone is like you.
But the queen is, said the Unseelie King. I know it, because Ash would not be the first.
He grinned a skeleton grin.
Annabel Blackthorne, you have toyed with me because I have allowed it. You have no true power here.
I know your name, Annabel gasped. Malcolm told it to me. I can force you.
You will die the moment the name leaves your lips, and Ash will die after, said the king. But because I do not wish bloodshed, I will give you one night to decide. Give me the true Black Volume, and you may remain here with Ash and be his guardian. If not, I shall join forces with the queen instead and drive you from my lands, and you will never see Ash again.
Ash pulled away from Annabel's restraining hands.
What if I say no? What if I refuse?
The king turned his red gaze on the boy.
You are a perfect candidate for the dark artifices, he said. But in the end, do you truly think I would stop at harming Sebastian Morgenstern's brat?
The name was like a blow.
Sebastian Morgenstern. But how?
No!
Annabel screamed.
Don't you touch him!
Guards, said the king, and the guards snapped to attention. Take the woman and the boy away. I am done with them.
Julian scrambled to his feet.
We have to follow them.
We can't,
Emma whispered.
The potion is wearing off. Look, the red light is almost gone.
Julian glanced down. The scarlet glow above his heart had dimmed to an ember. The guards had closed about Annabel and Ash and were marching them from the chamber. Emma caught hold of Julian's hand and together they crept out from behind the boulders. The guards were escorting Annabel and Ash out of the arched doorway. For a moment, Emma and Julian paused in the center of the throne room, directly in line of the king's view. He was staring straight ahead of him. In the untouched side of his face, Emma thought she could see a bit of Kieran. A Kieran split down the middle, half tortured and inhuman. She felt Julian's hand tighten on hers. Every one of her nerves was screaming that the king could see them, that at any moment he would call for his guards, that they would die here before Emma even got a chance to lift a blade. She told herself she would at least try to plunge her dagger into the king's heart before she died. Julian tugged her fingers. Incredibly, he had the map in his other hand. He jerked his chin toward the arch beneath which Ash and Annabel had vanished. There was no more time. They raced through the archway. There was little point in struggling. There were at least three fairy guards on each side of Mark, and their grip on his arms was merciless. He was dragged through the revel, still dizzy from the potion in his blood. Shapes seemed to loom up on either side of him, spinning dancers, blurred as if seen through the prism of a teardrop. The king of cats, regarding him with glimmering tabby eyes. A row of horses, rearing away from the sparks of a fire. He couldn't see Kieran. Kieran was somewhere behind him. Mark could hear the guards shouting at him, almost drowned out by the sounds of music and laughter. Kieran. Christina. His heart was a cold knot of fear for both of them as he was shoved through a filthy puddle and up a set of wooden steps. A flap of velvet canopy slapped him in the face. Mark sputtered as the guard holding him laughed. There were hands at his waist, unfastening his weapons belt. He kicked out reflexively and was shoved to the floor.
"Kneel, half-breed," snapped one of the guards.
They released him, and Mark crouched where he was, on his knees, his chest throbbing with rage. Two guards stood behind him, holding spears level with the back of Mark's neck. A few feet away, Kieran was in the same position, though he was bleeding from a cut lip. His expression was set in a bitter snarl. They were inside Oban's pavilion. The walls were heavy, hanging velvet, the floor expensive rugs that had been trampled and muddied by uncountable booted feet. Wooden tables held dozens of empty and half-empty bottles of wine. Some had tipped over and spilled, filling the room with a reek of alcohol.
"Well, well," said a drawling voice.
Mark looked up. In front of them was a red velvet sofa, and sprawled on it was an indolent-looking young man. Hair streaked black and purple tumbled around his pointed ears, and black coal was smudged around glittering silver eyes. He wore a silver silk doublet and hose, and white lace spilled from his cuffs.
"Little brother Kieran, how nice to see you."
His silver eyes flicked to Mark.
"With some guy."
He flicked a dismissive hand in Mark's direction and turned his smirk on Manuel.
"Good work."
"I told you I saw them," Manuel said. "They were at the revel."
"I admit it never occurred to me they'd be stupid enough to set foot in the Unseelie lands," said Oban. "You win that point, Villalobos."
"They make an excellent gift," said Manuel.
He stood between the guards with their spears, his arms crossed over his chest. He was grinning.
"Your father will be pleased."
"My father."
Oban tapped his fingers on the arm of the sofa.
"You think I should deliver Kieran to my father? He'll just kill them, dull."
Mark darted a glance at Kieran through his eyelashes. Kieran was on his knees. He didn't look frightened of Oban, but he'd never show it if he was.
"A gift is more than just a gift," said Manuel. "It's a matter of persuasion. Your father, mistakenly, thinks you are weak, Prince. If you bring him Prince Kieran and the Shadow Hunter half-breed, he'll realize he should take you more seriously."
He lowered his voice.
"We can't convince him to kill the prisoners and move ahead with our plan."
"Prisoners? What prisoners?" Mark tensed. Could he mean Julian and Emma? But that was impossible. They were with the Seelie procession. At least Christina was safe. She had vanished, eluding the guards. The angel knew where she was now. Mark chanced a sideways glance at Kieran. Wasn't he panicking, too? Wasn't he terrified for Christina, as Mark was? He ought to be, considering the way they'd been kissing. Oban reached for the side table and scrabbled around among the bottles stacked on top of it, looking for one with alcohol still in it.
"My father does not respect me," he said. "He thinks my brothers are more worthy of the throne, though they are not."
"I'm sure they think the same thing about you," Mark muttered.
Oban found a bottle and lifted it up to the light, squinting at a half inch of amber fluid still inside.
"A wanted prisoner might change his mind, but it might not be enough."
"You do want to rise in your father's favor, do you not?" said Manuel.
Oban took a swig from his bottle.
"Of course," Rather.
Mark had the feeling Manuel was rolling his eyes internally.
Then you need to demonstrate that he should take you seriously. First time you went to him, he wouldn't even hear you out.
Fatuous old bag, muttered Oban, tossing the empty bottle aside. It shattered.
If you bring him the prisoners, he will listen to you. I will go with you. I will tell him that together we track them down. I will make it clear that as a representative of the cohort, I wish to work only with you as our contact in the Unseelie Court. It will make you seem important.
Seem, said Oban.
Kieran made an inelegant snorting noise.
It will make him understand how important you are,
Manuel corrected smoothly.
Your father will realize the value you bring to him. The hostages are the key to a parley between Nephilim and the Unseelie folk that has no precedent in our history. When every shadow hunter sees you meet and achieve a mutually beneficial peace, all will realize that you and Horace Dearborn are the greatest of leaders, able to achieve an alliance your forefathers could not.
What?
Said Mark, unable to stay silent.
What are you talking about?
Might it not bring a real war?
Oban had found another bottle. War seems like a bad idea. With exasperated patience, Manuel said,
There will be no war, I told you.
He glanced at Kieran and then at Mark.
War is not the object here, and I think the king wants Kieran dead more than you think.
Because the people love him, said Oban in a maudlin tone. They wanted him to be king because he was kind.
Kindness is not a kingly quality, said Manuel. As the people will discover when your father hangs Kieran from a gibbet high above the tower gardens.
Mark jerked backward and nearly impaled himself on a spear.
You!
Kindness may not be a kingly quality, but mercy is, interrupted Kieran. You don't have to do this, Oban. Manuel is not worth your effort, and his schemes are so many lies.
Oban sighed.
You are tediously predictable, youngest son.
He dropped the bottle he was holding, and the scarlet liquid in it ran out onto the floor like blood.
I want the throne, and I shall have the throne, and Manuel will help me get it. That's all I care about. That's all that matters.
A smile touched the corners of his mouth.
Unlike you, I have not come to love and pursue shadows,
but only what is real. Remember, Mark thought, remember that none of this is real.
Oban flicked a hand toward the two of them as Manuel smirked almost audibly.
Chain them together and find them horses. We ride for the Unseelie Court this night.
Barnabas was already at the 101 coffee shop in Hollywood when Drusilla arrived. He was sitting at a tan booth and forking up a plate of delicious-looking huevos rancheros. He sported a black cowboy hat and a bolo tie that seemed to be choking him, but he looked pleased with himself. Drew stopped to glance at her reflection in the windows that ran along one side of the diner. The other side was a kitschy rock wall. In the corner, there was a jukebox and dozens of framed photos of what Drew guessed were the owner's family and friends. It was dark outside, and the window gave her back a clear picture of herself. Dark hair, pulled up and smooth, gray business suit, classic heels, stolen from Emma's closet. She wore red lipstick and no other makeup. Kit had assured her that less was more.
You don't want to look like a clown, he'd said, tossing her powder blush in racy rows over his shoulder as if it were a grenade.
Somewhere out there in the shadows, Kit and Ty were watching, ready to jump to her defense if anything went wrong. Knowing that made her feel less worried. Hoisting her briefcase in her hand, she sauntered across the diner past ivory and toffee-colored leather seats and slid into the booth across from Barnabas. His snake eyes flicked up to observe her. Up close, he didn't look well. His scales were dull, and his eyes rimmed with red.
Vanessa Ashdown.
That's me, Drew said, setting the briefcase down on her placemat. In the flesh. His forked tongue slithered out of his mouth.
And plenty of it. No worries, I like a woman with curves. Most of you shadow hunters are so bony. Blech, Drew thought.
She tapped the briefcase. Business, Mr. Hale?
Right.
His tongue vanished, to her relief.
So, Toots, you've got proof that Hypatia Vex has been passing secrets to shadow hunters?
Right in here. Drew smiled and pushed the briefcase toward him. He unsnapped it and flicked it open, then frowned.
This is money.
Yes. She gave him a bright smile and tried not to glance around to see if anyone was coming to back her up. It's the money we've earmarked for Hypatia in exchange for secrets. He rolled his eyes.
Normally, I'm happy to see a big box of money. Don't get me wrong. But I was kind of hoping for photos of her handing evidence to some Blackthorns.
Why Blackthorns? Drusilla said.
Because, said Barnabas, they're smarmy little rats. He sat back up. You've got to give me something better than this, Vanessa.
Well, look closer at the money. Drew played for time. Because, it's not ordinary money.
Looking bored, Barnabas picked up a stack of 20s. Drew tensed.
Kit had told her to keep Barnabas talking, but it wasn't like she could distract him by telling him the plot of Bloody Birthday or about the new cute thing Church had done.
There isn't anything special about this money, Barnabas began,
and broke off as the door of the diner flew open and a tall warlock woman with dark skin and bronze hair strode into the room. She wore a glimmering pantsuit and toweringly high heels. She was followed by two other downworlders, a muscled male werewolf and a pallid, dark-haired vampire.
Damn, said Barnabas. Hypatia, what?
I heard you were selling secrets to Shadow Hunters, Hale, said Hypatia. Look at that, caught with your hand in the bag.
She winked at Drew. The pupils of her eyes were shaped like golden stars. How could you? Demanded the vampire. I thought it was all lies, Barnabas. She sniffed and glanced at Drew.
You were really buying secrets off him? Who are you, anyway?
Drusilla, said Drew. Drusilla Blackthorn.
A Blackthorn? Said Barnabas, outraged.
And he was definitely selling secrets, said Drew. For instance, he just told me he dug up a copy of the Red Scrolls of Magic from under Johnny Rook's booth as soon as he died, and he's keeping it to himself.
Is that true? Rumbled the werewolf. And you call yourself head of the shadow market? You little!
Barnabas launched himself across the table at Drew. She slid out of the booth fast and collided with someone's torso with an oomph. She looked up. It was Ty, a short sword in his hand, pointed directly at Barnabas's chest. He put one arm protectively around Drew, his gaze never wavering from the warlock.
Leave my sister alone, he said.
That's right, said Kit.
He waved from the next booth. I forgot my weapons, but I do have this fork, he wiggled it.
You are so forked, he said to Barnabas.
Oh, shut up,
Barnabas said.
But he looked defeated. The werewolf had already grabbed him, pulling his arms behind his back. Hypatia was clearing the briefcase and money off the table. She winked her starry eyes at Ty and Drew.
Time for you shadow hunters to go, she said. This marks the end of your little downworlder deal. And tell your new inquisitor that we don't want anything to do with him or his bigoted rules. We'll go where we want, when we want.
Ty lowered his sword slowly. Kit dropped the fork, and the three of them strode out of the diner. Once on the pavement, Drew took a deep, relieved breath of air. It was a warm night, and the moon was high and glowing over Franklin Avenue. She felt shivery with excitement. She'd done it. She tricked a famous warlock, pulled off a con. She was a con woman now.
I think Hypatia meant what she said to us, said Kit, glancing back through the windows of the coffee shop. Hypatia and the other downworlders were escorting a struggling Barnabas toward the back door. All that stuff about telling the Inquisitor? That wasn't part of the con. That was a real message.
As if we could get word to the Inquisitor, said Ty. He touched his hand absently to the locket at his throat. That was good. You did a really good job, Drew.
Yep, kept you cool, said Kit.
He glanced up and down the street. I suggest we go get milkshakes or something to celebrate. But this is kind of a scary neighborhood. Shadowhunters don't worry about scary neighborhoods, said Drew.
Have you learned nothing from the way Batman's parents died? Said Kit, feigning shock.
Ty smiled, and for the first time since Livy had died, Drew laughed. With Aline and Tabby's help, Helen had set up a large table inside the sanctuary. Two chairs sat behind it, and the table was covered with the accoutrements of bureaucracy, pens and blank forms that had been sent by the Clave, file folders and rubber stamps. It was all drearily mundane, in Helen's opinion. A long line of werewolves, warlocks, vampires, and fairies stretched through the room and out the front doors. They had set up their registry station atop the angelic power rune etched on the floor, blocking the doors that led into the Institute. The first downworlder to step up to their makeshift office was a werewolf. He had an enormous mustache that reminded Helen of 70s cop movies. He was glowering.
My name is Greg.
Your name is Elton John, Aline said, writing it down.
No, said the werewolf. It's Greg. Greg Anderson.
It's Elton John, said Aline, grabbing a stamp. You're 36, and you're a chimney sweep who lives in Bel Air. She stamped the paper in red ink, registered, and handed it back. The werewolf took the paper, blinking in puzzlement.
What are you doing?
It means the Clave won't be able to find you, explained Tabby, who was sitting under the table, playing with a toy car. But you're registered.
Technically, said Helen, willing him to accept the ruse. If he didn't, they'd have trouble with the others. Greg looked at the paper again.
Just my opinion, he said. But the guy behind me looks like Humphrey Bogart.
Humphrey it is, said Aline, waving her stamp. Do you want to be Humphrey Bogart? She asked the next downworlder, a skinny, tall warlock with a sad face and poodle ears.
Who doesn't? Said the warlock.
Most of the downworlders were wary as they worked their way through the rest of the line, but cooperative. There were even some smiles and thanks. They seemed to understand that Aline and Helen were attempting to undermine the system, if not why. Aline pointed at a tall blonde fairy in the line wearing a gossamer dress.
That one's Taylor Swift.
Helen smiled as she handed a werewolf a stamped form. How much trouble are we going to get into for this?
Doesn't matter, said Aline. We're going to do it anyway.
True enough, said Helen, and reached for another form.
Take me to him. Take me. There was quiet and silence, and then light and 1,000 sharp, prickling pains. Christina yelped and struggled free of what felt like a tangle of briars, tumbling sideways and thumping hard onto grassy earth. She sat up, looking ruefully down at her hands and arms, dotted with dozens of tiny pinpricks of blood. She had landed in a rose bush, which was more than a little ironic. She got to her feet, brushing herself off. She was still in fairy, but it seemed to be daytime here. Golden sunlight burnished a thatched roof cottage of pale yellow stone. A turquoise blue river ran past the small house, lined with blue and purple lupin flowers. Christina wasn't sure what she had expected, but it hadn't been this pastoral bliss. She dabbed gently at the blood on her hands and arms, gave up, and glanced up and down the small, winding trail that cut through the tall grass. It led from the front door of the cottage across the meadow and vanished into the hazy distance. Christina marched up to the cottage door and knocked firmly.
Adean, she called. Adean Kingson.
The door swung open as if Adean had been waiting on the other side. The last time Christina had seen him, he had been decked out in the regalia of the Unseelie Court, with the broken crown insignia on his chest. Now he wore a plain linen tunic and breeches. His deep brown skin looked warm in the sunlight. It was the first time she'd been able to see his resemblance to Kieran. Maybe it was because he looked furious.
How is it possible you are here? He demanded, looking around as if he couldn't believe she'd come alone. I sought help, she said. I was in fairy.
He narrowed his eyes. He seemed to be staring suspiciously at a bluebird. Come inside immediately. It is not safe to speak outside. The moment she was inside the cottage, Adean closed the door and set himself to fastening a number of intricate-looking, complicated locks. Faerie is a dangerous place right now. There are all sorts of ways you could have been tracked or followed. They were inside a small, wood-paneled entryway. An arched doorway led through to the rest of the cottage. Adean was blocking it, arms crossed in front of his chest. He was glowering. After a moment's hesitation, Christina held out the artifact to him.
I could not have been tracked. I used this.
If she'd hoped Adean would look relieved, he didn't.
Where did you get that?
It's a family heirloom, Christina said. It was given freely as a gift by a family of Adas, who an ancestor of mine aided.
Adean scowled.
It is a medallion of Rhiannon. Treat it with care.
He stalked out of the entryway and into a small living room, where a well-scrubbed wooden table stood in a shaft of sunlight pouring through wide, leaded windows. A small kitchen was visible. A vase on the table held a riot of colorful flowers and stacked bowls of painted pottery. Christina felt a bit as if she were inside the cottage of the dwarves in Snow White. Everything was diminutive, and Adean seemed to tower, his head nearly scraping the ceiling. He gestured for her to sit down. She took a chair, realizing as she sat how exhausted her body was and how much she ached all over. Worry for Emma and Julian, now compounded by panic over Mark and Kieran, pounded through her like heartbeats.
Why are you here? Adean demanded.
He wasn't sitting. His big arms were still crossed over his chest.
I need your help, Christina said.
Adean slammed a hand down on the table, making her jump.
No, I cannot give aid or help to a Nephilim. I may not agree with my father on many things, but I would not go directly against his wishes by conspiring to aid a shadow hunter.
He stood for a moment in silence. Sunlight illuminated the edges of the white lace curtains at the window. Through the glass, Christina could see a field of poppies stretching away in the distance toward glimmering cliffs and a faint sparkle of blue water. The house smelled like sage and tea, a soft and homey scent that made the ache inside her worse.
Do you know why I came to you? She said.
I do not, Adean said grimly.
In London, I followed Kieran from the Institute because I didn't trust him, she said. I thought he was on his way to betray us. It turned out he was on his way to speak to you.
Adean's frown didn't budge.
I realized as the two of you were talking that he was right to trust you, that you were the only one of his brothers who cared for him, said Christina. He said that you gave him Windspear. You are the only member of his family who he speaks of with any affection at all.
Adean threw up a hand as if to ward off her words.
Enough! I don't want to hear any more. You need to hear it. I do not need the Nephilim to tell me about Kieran.
You do, said Christina. Guards are taking Kieran to your father right now, as we speak. He will certainly be killed if we do nothing.
Adean didn't move. If Christina didn't see him swallow, she would have thought he was a statue, an angry, towering statue. Helping him would be a true betrayal of my father.
If you don't help, then it will be a true betrayal of your brother, said Christina. Sometimes you cannot be loyal to everyone.
Adean leaned his big hands on the back of a chair.
Why did you come here? He said. Why did you bring me this news? It is possible the king will spare him. He is well liked by the people.
You know your father will kill him for just that reason, said Christina. Her voice shook. Before the hunt, no one in Kieran's life ever loved or cared for him at all, save you. Are you really going to abandon him now?
Chapter 15 Turrets and Shadows.
Sebastian's son,
Emma whispered.
He had a son.
They had taken shelter in a room that looked like a disused food pantry. Bare shelves lined the walls and empty baskets littered the floor. Emma thought of the fruit and bread they had once held and tried to ignore the gnawing of her stomach. She hadn't eaten since the sandwiches the day before.
There have always been rumors that Sebastian had an affair with the queen, Julian said. He was sitting with his back against the wall of the pantry. His voice sounded remote, as if it were coming from the bottom of a well. He'd sounded like that since they'd left the throne room. Emma didn't know if it was a side effect of the potion or of seeing Annabelle and letting her go. But he only died 5 years ago.
Time passes differently in Faerie, said Emma. Ash seems maybe 13,
she scowled.
He looks like Sebastian. I remember seeing Sebastian in the Institute. He was so vicious, cold, inhuman.
Blonde. Julian didn't look up. His voice was like ice. You should have let me end her.
Julian, no.
Emma rubbed at her temples. Her head was aching. You would absolutely have been killed if you tried.
Emma.
No! She dropped her hands. I hate Annabelle, too. I hate her for standing there alive when Livy's dead.
I hate her for what she did. But there are more important things at stake right now than our revenge.
Julian raised his head.
You lived for revenge for years. All you thought about was revenge for your parents.
I know. And then I got my revenge, and it did nothing for me. It left me feeling empty and cold.
Did it?
His eyes were cold and hard as blue-green marbles.
Yes, Emma insisted.
Also, then Malcolm came back from the dead as a sea monster, so
you're saying I shouldn't kill Annabelle because she'll come back as a sea monster?
I'm just pointing out the futility of murdering Malcolm, said Emma. And you know who ended up killing him in the end? Annabelle.
There was a long silence. Julian ran his fingers through his hair. Emma wanted to crawl across the room to him, on her hands and knees, to beg him to go back to being the Julian he used to be. But maybe that was impossible. Maybe Livy's death had fallen like a scythe between that Julian and this one, killing any possibility that he might transform, like the swan princes in the fairy tale, back into the thoughtful, considering boy she loved, with secrets in his heart and paint on his hands.
So, what are you saying? He asked at last.
No one would blame you for killing Annabelle, said Emma. But sometimes we have to put aside what we want right now for something bigger. You taught me that, the old you.
Maybe, said Julian.
He yanked down his sleeve, and Emma saw again what she had seen in the clearing, the peculiar rust-splashed cloth tied around his right wrist. She put a hand on his arm, stilling his movement.
What is that?
It's Livy's blood, he said. I tore a strip off the shirt I was wearing when she died and tied it to my wrist. I'll take it off when I kill Annabelle. Not before.
Julian.
He pulled his sleeve back down.
I understand what you're saying. I just don't see why I should be the one to stop.
His voice was toneless. Emma felt cold all over. It was like looking at someone bleeding from a mortal wound who didn't seem to know or understand that they were hurt.
Anyway, Julian said, we need to go find Ash.
I failed, Emma thought. There was something else I should have said, something that would have convinced him, and I failed.
Why do we need to find Ash?
You heard the king. Ash is the weapon, the one that Clary and Jace came to find.
He's part of a weapon, Emma said. The king is poisoning his own land, and Broslyn Forest, too. He thinks he can use Ash to make the poison even more deadly, to destroy more of Idris.
That's the impression I got, yeah. But the king needs the Black Volume to make that second part work.
Then aren't we better going off after the Black Volume?
Which one? Julian said. Annabelle has the real one. The queen has the copy. Well, the king has it at the moment, but it's hers. That splits our goal. Unless we pull Ash out of the equation.
Julian's hair tumbled around his face in the darkness.
Emma could see the thin scratches all over his skin where the thorns of the hedge had cut him. Both of his bargains hinge on Ash. Annabelle wants Ash, and so does the Queen. Taking Ash will buy us time and prevent the King from making a deal.
I'm not hurting a little kid, Julian, Emma said flatly. If that's what you mean by pull Ash out of the equation, I'm not doing it.
We don't have to hurt him, Julian said. Kidnapping him should work just fine. Emma sighed. And then what? We offer Annabelle a trade. The black volume for Ash. She'd do anything for him. Emma wondered if she ought to point out how strange that was. She decided not to. This Julian didn't understand why anyone felt strongly about anything. Then we kill her and take the book, he finished.
What about the Queen?
If the King doesn't have Ash, she's got no reason to trade the black volume, and she won't. Meanwhile, we get to the Falls, head back to Idris, with Ash and the original black volume, and Dearborn's plan is shot. We walk into the Council with both those things, and we'll be heroes. The Clave won't let the cohort touch us.
Ash isn't a thing, said Emma.
The King called him a weapon, said Julian. Emma changed tack.
We don't know how to find Ash in the tower.
I know you saw those guards in the corridor, just like I did, Julian said. And later in the throne room. They're Ash's guards. We know where his room is. We've seen it. His eyes were glittering with determination. I need you with me, Emma.
Then promise me something, she said. Promise we'll take Ash to Gia, not Dearborn.
Fine, said Julian. I don't care what happens to Sebastian Morgenstern's son.
Real Julian would have cared, Emma thought. Real Julian would have cared about any child, because he loved his so much. He would have seen Tavi and Ash, and Drew, and Ty, no matter who Ash's father was.
So will you come with me? He said.
I will, she thought, because someone has to protect Ash from you, and protect you from yourself.
She rose to her feet.
I'm with you, she said. Hello?
Ty moved forward into the darkness of the cave, his witch light shining in his hand. He looked like a painting to Kit, with the illumination bright on his dark hair and pale skin.
Shade? Are you here?
Kit had his own witchlight in his pocket, but Ty's stone was casting plenty of light, picking out the cracks in the granite walls, the wooden table scored with old marks of knives and fire, the letters on its surface flaring briefly into life. Fire wants to burn. They left Drew back at the Institute, where she'd gone humming off to bed, and Kit had been pleased they'd made her happy. She'd done well with Barnabas, too. Kit had been right. She had plenty of con artists in her.
Shade, Ty had said the moment Drusilla was out of earshot. We have to talk to Shade.
He'd been vibrating with excitement, his cheeks flushed, his fingers working at one of his fidget toys. It was a clear night with a three-quarter moon, the sky alive with fast-moving clouds, blown by wind off the ocean. Ty practically ran across the edge of the water, feet soundlessly on the damp sand. Kit found he wasn't quite as breathless as he would have expected trying to keep up. Maybe he was turning into more of a shadow hunter despite himself.
Shade,
Ty called again, and this time the shadows moved, and a light flared up inside the cavern. A lamp on the table had switched on, filling the chamber with illumination and shadows. Out of the deeper shadows, a grumpy voice spoke.
Who is it? Who's bothering me?
Kit Herondale and Ty Blackthorn, Ty said, his witchlight flaring higher. We need to talk to you.
There was a sigh and a shuffle.
You'd better have a good reason for waking me up.
The shadows moved and resolved themselves into shade, clambering out of a sleeping bag. He wore a pair of pinstriped pajamas and fuzzy slippers on his green feet.
We sent you a note saying we were coming, said Kit.
Shade glared.
I was asleep. It's 3 in the morning.
The sleeping bag wiggled. A moment later, Church crawled out, making chirping noises. He curled up on top of the bag, blinking his large yellow eyes. That isn't very loyal, Ty said, looking at Church sternly. Shade yawned.
We've known each other for a long time, that cat and I. We had some things to catch up on.
Kit felt the conversation getting away from him. We did what you told us to do, he said to the yawning warlock. We're square with the shadow market. That's right, said Ty. Hypatia Vex is running it now, and she says we can come there whenever we want. An odd expression passed over the warlock's face. Interestingly, Shade did not look happy. He looked surprised and disturbed. Kit filed the fact away for future consideration.
Then you can begin the spell, said Shade slowly. Once you have acquired all the ingredients, of course.
What are the ingredients? Asked Kit. Please tell me we don't have to do the Malcolm thing with the hands of 12 murderers. I don't know 12 murders. I don't even know 12 shoplifters.
No, Shade had begun to pace.
Malcolm brought Annabel back the way he did because he had a body. We don't have your sister's body, so we can't use his methods.
She wasn't my sister, murmured Kit.
If I remember correctly, there's only one spell from the book that you can use, said Shade, still pacing.
That's right, said Ty.
There's really a spell? Kit said. They both looked at him.
I don't see how we can bring back someone from the dead when their body is gone.
Ty had gone tense all over. The book says you can do it, he said. It says it's possible.
Shade snapped his fingers, and a mug of something steaming appeared on the table. He slumped into the chair and curled his hands around it, looking grim, or as grim as a green warlock with fuzzy slippers could look.
Because there's no body, this is a highly unstable spell, he said. You aren't the first to try it. Nothing is ever truly destroyed. That much is true. There are ways that the bodiless dead can be returned. Their spirit can be placed in another body, but that is true evil, because the first body will die.
No, said Ty. I don't want that. Livy wouldn't want that.
The body can return as a living corpse, Shade went on. Not dead, but not entirely alive. The body could come back with a corrupted mind, looking perfectly like Livy, but unable to think or speak. The disembodied spirit might return, or in some cases a Livy from another world, like Edom, could be snatched into ours, leaving a hole behind in the world she departed.
It seems like there aren't any good options, Kit said nervously.
But it can work, said Ty. All the blood had drained from his face. It has worked in the past. People have been brought back perfectly.
Unfortunately, said Shade. Yes.
Kit already knew that yes was all Ty would hear. We'll get it right, Ty said. We'll get the real Livy back. Kit felt the back of his neck prickle. He couldn't tell if Ty was panicking, but Kit definitely was. What in his life had he ever gotten so right that he had the nerve to volunteer for a project that absolutely couldn't go wrong?
What are the things we need from the market? Ty said. He didn't sound like he was panicking, and his calmness let Kit breathe again.
Shade sighed and drew a piece of paper toward him across the desk. He must already have scribbled on it some time before. He began to read the list out loud.
Incense from the heart of a volcano. Chalk powdered from the bones of a murder victim. Blood, hair, and bone of the person to be brought over. Myrrh grown by fairies, harvested at midnight with a silver sickle. An object from another world.
The person to be brought over, Ty said. That's Livy, right?
Of course, Shade said.
Without her body, how can we get her blood, hair, and bone? Said Kit.
His mind raced along with the question.
Maybe it would be impossible. Maybe they couldn't get the ingredients. and there would never be a chance of getting the spell wrong and inviting disaster.
It can be done, said Ty quietly. His fingers touched the locket at his neck briefly. The incense, the myrrh, we can get those at the market.
What about the object from another world? Said Kit.
There are a few in this dimension, said Shade. Most are in the spiral labyrinth. He held up a hand. And before you ask, no, I will not help you get one. My assistance ends with advising you.
Ty frowned. But we'll need you to help with the spell, he said. Shadowhunters, we can't do magic. Kit knew what Ty meant. Warlocks were among the few who could naturally do magic in the world. Magicians, like his father, had to find an energy source because they couldn't tap into ley lines. The energy sources, especially clean ones like the one Shade had promised them, weren't easy to get. Even if you could find someone to sell you a catalyst, Shadowhunters were forbidden by law to buy that sort of thing. And even if Ty didn't care about breaking the law, it would take him years to learn how to perform magic the way Johnny Rook had.
I said I would contribute a catalyst you could use, said Shade. You must do the rest yourselves. I will not touch necromancy.
Church meowed. Ty picked up the list of ingredients. His eyes were deep and dark, more black than gray in the cave light.
Okay, he said. Good enough.
He took out his witchlight and gestured for Kit to follow him. Shade rose to his feet and said something about walking them out. Kit hurried after Ty, who seemed as eager to be gone as he had been to come in the first place. They had reached the end of the tunnel where the rock opened out into sand and ocean, when Shade put his hand on Kit's shoulder.
Christopher, he said, wait one moment.
Ty had already made his way out onto the beach. He was bent over. Kit realized he was stroking Church's fur. The cat had followed them out soundlessly and was making figure eights between Ty's legs, rubbing his head against the boy's calves.
Watch over, Tiberius, said Shade. There was something in his voice, an inflection, that made it sound as if he'd learned English a long time ago. There are many ways to be endangered by magic.
Kit glanced up in surprise.
What do you mean? We don't have to kill anybody or create any death magic energy. Isn't that what makes necromancy wrong?
Shade sighed.
Magic is like thermodynamics, he said. You're always taking something from somewhere. Every act has repercussions, and this one may have repercussions you do not expect and cannot guard against. I see you think of yourself as Ty's protector, his voice gentled. Sometimes you need to guard people against the things they want, as well as the things they fear.
Kit's heart clenched. Out on the beach, Ty straightened up. The wind blew his hair, and he reached up his hands, unhesitating and unselfconscious, to touch the wind and the night air. His face shone like a star. In all the world, Kit had never met anyone he believed to be so incapable of evil.
I would never let anything hurt Ty, he said. You see, I...
He turned to tell Shade, to explain to him how it was, how it would always be. But the warlock had disappeared.
Mark's skin burned softly where the iron manacles had been chained around his wrists. Oban and his guards rode ahead on their horses. Manuel was in among them, as if it were natural for a shadow hunter to ride among unseelly hosts. He turned occasionally to smirk at Mark and Kieran, who walked behind the group. Manacles circled both their wrists, connected to a thick iron chain that clipped to the pommel of Oban's saddle. It was a punishment Mark had seen before. He kept an anxious eye on Kieran in case he stumbled. A prisoner who fell would be dragged along behind the unseelie horses while the guards laughed. Kieran was already pale with pain. The cold iron affected him much more than it did Mark. His wrists were bleeding and chafed where the iron touched them.
They spoke of hostages,
he said finally as they reached the crest of a low hill.
Whose death are we being exchanged for? We'll find out soon enough, said Mark.
I am afraid, said Kieran, naked honesty in his voice. Manuel Villalobos was at the Scholomance when I was hiding there. He's a terrible person. There is nothing he would not do. Most of the cohort strike me as followers rather than leaders, even Zara. She does as her father tells her, as she has been taught, though they are teachings of hatred and cruelty. But Manuel is different. He does what he does because he wishes to cause people pain. Yes, said Mark, it's what makes him dangerous. He isn't a true believer.
He glanced around him. They were passing near to a patch of blight. He had started to get used to seeing the sight of them, annihilated landscapes of ashy grass and dead trees, as if acid had been poured onto the earth from the sky.
We can't trust in Christina, he said in a near whisper. She will be looking for help for us, even now.
Did you notice something curious, said Kieran. Obon did not ask us about her, where she might have vanished to, or who she might have sought out.
Perhaps he was aware we did not know.
Kieran snorted. No, Manuel did not tell him Christina was ever there, mark my words. He would prefer Obon not be angry he let a shadow hunter escape.
What is Manuel doing with Obon? No offense, but Obon doesn't seem like the brightest of your siblings.
Kieran's eyes narrowed. He's a drunkard and a turnip.
But an ambitious turnip.
Kieran chuckled reluctantly. It seems to me that Manuel has stoked Obon's ambition. It is true that the cohort cannot influence my father, but perhaps they hope to influence who the next Unseelie King might be. A weak one that they can influence easily. Obon would be perfect for that.
They crested another hill. Mark could see the tower rise in the distance, a black thorn piercing the blue sky. He had flown over the Unseelie Tower with the Wild Hunt, but he had never been inside. He had never wanted to go.
Why would Manuel think that there was a new Unseelie King anytime soon? Your father has been king for so long, no one can remember what King Brahm looked like.
Kieran glanced at the tower. A fresh burst of laughter came from Obon and the others ahead.
Perhaps it was because the people are angry with my father. I hear things from Medeon. There are whispers of discontent, that the king has brought this blight down upon our land, that his obsession with shadow hunters has left his people divided and impoverished. The elder fairies of Unseelie have mistrusted him since the disappearance of the first heir. They feel that the king did not try hard enough to find her.
Mark was startled.
The first heir was a girl? I thought that the king murdered all his female children.
Kieran didn't say anything. Mark recalled the last time they had faced the king and fairy, when Mark had come with Emma and Jules and Christina to save Kieran from the Lord of Shadows. Things were different now. He flashed back suddenly to a clearing, awakening to see Christina and Kieran in each other's arms just before the guards had come.
Why did you kiss Christina? Mark said quietly. If you did it to upset me or make me jealous, that was a terrible thing to do to her.
Kieran turned to him with surprise.
It was not to upset you or make you jealous, Mark.
She likes you, Mark said.
He had known it for some time, but had never spoken the words aloud before.
Kieran flushed. That is very strange to me. I do not deserve it.
I am not sure I deserve her fondness either, said Mark.
Perhaps she does not bestow her heart with the care she should. He glanced down at his bleeding wrists.
Do not hurt her.
I could not, said Kieran. I would not.
And I'm sorry, Mark, if you were jealous. I had not intended that.
It is all right, Mark said with a kind of puzzlement, as if he were surprised at the truth.
I wasn't jealous. Not of either of you. How is that possible?
The shadow of the tower fell over them, darkening the ground where they stood. The air seemed suddenly colder. In front of them, the massive thorned hedge that ringed the tower rose up like a wall of spikes. White bones hung from the thorny spikes, as they had hung for hundreds of years. It had been a long, long time since a warrior had challenged the wall.
and Mark could not remember ever having heard of one who had done so and lived.
Mark, Karen whispered.
Mark took a step forward and nearly stumbled. The chain connecting them to the horses lay limp on the ground. Oban and the others had paused in the archway of the enormous gates that were the only way through the thorn hedge. Kieran reached for Mark and caught at his shoulder with his manacled hands. His lips were cracked and bleeding. He stared into Mark's eyes with a look of terrible pleading. Mark forgot their strange discussion about Christina, forgot everything but Kieran's pain and his own desire to protect him.
Mark, Kieran breathed, I have to warn you. We will walk the path of punishment to the tower. I've seen this happen to others. I cannot.
Kieran?
It will be all right.
No.
Kieran shook his head wildly enough to make his dark blue hair fly around his head. My father will have lined the path to the tower with the gentry. They will scream at us. They will throw rocks and stones. So my father wants it. He threatened me with it after Irlath's death. Now I'm responsible for Erek's death as well. There will be no mercy for me. He choked on his words. I'm sorry you have to be here for this.
Feeling strangely calm, Mark said, Isn't it better to have me with you?
No, Kieran said, and in his eyes Mark thought he saw the ocean, black and silver under the moon, distant and untouchable, beautiful and everlasting. Because I love you. The world seemed to rush away into silence.
But I thought, you said we would be done with each other.
I am not done with you, said Kieran. I could never be done with you, Mark Blackthorn.
Mark's whole body hummed with surprise. He barely registered it when they began to move forward again, until Kieran's grip slid from his shoulder. Reality came rushing back in, a smacking wave. He heard Kieran suck in his breath, steeling himself for the worst as they passed through the gates after Oban and the others. Their chains rattled over the cobblestones of the path that led from the gates to the doors of the tower, an obscenely loud noise. The courtyard on either side was packed with unseelie fairies. Some carried stones, while some held whips made of thorny vines. Fumbling slightly, twisting his wrist against the manacles, Mark managed to take Kieran's hand in his.
We will go forward without fear, he said in a low voice. For I am a shadow hunter, and you are the son of a king.
Kieran threw him a grateful look. A moment later they were moving along the path, and the crowd, bearing their whips and stones, had flanked them on either side. Mark raised his head. They would not see a shadow hunter cringe in fear or pain. Beside him, Kieran had straightened his back. His expression was haughty, his body braced. Braced for blows that did not come. As Mark and Kieran walked between the rows of fairies, they stood as still as statues, their rocks unthrown, their whips unmoving. The only sound came from Oban and his guards, their muttering rising in the silent air. Oban twisted to the side, his angry gaze raking the crowd.
Bestir yourselves, imbeciles, he shouted. Don't you know what you're supposed to be doing? These are murderers. They killed Irlath. They murdered Prince Erek.
A murmur went through the crowd, but it wasn't an angry murmur. Mark thought he heard Erek's name spoken in anger, and Kieran's with much more gentleness. Kieran himself was looking around in great surprise. And still, the crowd did not move. Instead, as Kieran and Mark moved through and among them, voices began to rise. Mark listened incredulously as each story was told.
He gave me bread when I was starving by the side of the road.
He intervened when the king's redcaps had taken my farm.
He saved my husband from execution. He took responsibility for a crime my child committed.
He tried to save my mother from the riders of Manon, and for his kindness, the king sent him to the wild hunt.
Oban whipped around, his face twisted in rage. Manuel laid his hand on Oban's shoulder. He leaned in and whispered in the prince's ear. Oban subsided, looking furious.
Kieran looked at Mark in astonishment, his lips half parted.
I do not understand, he whispered.
They hate your father, said Mark, but I do not think they hate you. They had reached the steps of the tower. They paused as Oban and the others dismounted. There was a flash of movement in the crowd. A small fairy child, a girl with her hair in ribbons and bare feet, slipped from among the other fey folk and darted up to Kieran. She pressed something shyly into his hand.
For your kindness, Prince Kieran.
What was that? Mark asked as Kieran closed his hand around the object. But the guards had already surrounded them and were pushing them toward the doors of the tower, and Kieran did not answer. As Diana flew with Gwyn over Brosseland, smoke furled up from the forest below like gray and black fingers unclosing against the sky. The cohort had burned the blighted areas, but haphazardly. Diana could see the smoking stumps of trees, but the gray-black ashy land stretched out even further than it had before, and some patches seemed untouched by fire. Diana looked on in dismay. What did the cohort think they were doing? They landed, and Gwyn helped Diana down from Orion's back. Gia was waiting for them anxiously. Diana ran to her.
I heard you had news about Emma and Julian. Are they all right? Have they been sent back to L.A.?
Gia hesitated. She was looking thin and drawn, her skin papery and gray.
They have not, no.
Relief flowed through Diana. So Emma and Julian were still in Alicante.
I was so worried at the meeting, she said. What Horace is doing to Diego and the others is unthinkable. Blaming them for crimes and sealing their mouths shut so they couldn't speak for themselves. It made me almost glad Emma and Julian are sequestered in that house.
Diana, no, Gia said. She laid a thin hand on Diana's wrist. Gwyn had come up and was listening quietly, his grizzled head tipped to one side.
A Clave member, someone loyal to me, overheard Zara talking to Manuel. She says that Horace sent Emma and Julian to Ferry on a suicide mission. I had my people check the house, and it's empty. They aren't here, Diana. They were sent to Ferry.
It was a soft explosion inside her head. Rage, fury, anger at herself.
She'd known something was wrong. Had felt it. Why hadn't she trusted her instincts?
Gwyn, she said, her voice barely recognizable in her own ears, take me to Ferry, now. Gia grabbed Diana's wrist.
Diana, think. Ferry is a huge land. We don't know where they might be.
Gwyn and his people are hunters, said Diana.
We will find them. Gwyn?
She turned to him, but he had stiffened all over, like a fox scenting hounds.
Where? He cried,
and whipped an axe from the scabbard on his back. The trees rustled. Gia and Diana barely had time to draw their own weapons when the cohort burst into the clearing, led by Zara Dearborn, brandishing a glittering sword. A glittering sword that Diana knew. With a feeling as if she had swallowed a lump of ice, Diana recognized Cortana. Jessica Beauséjour was with Zara, along with Anoush Joshi, Timothy Rockford, and Amelia Overbeck. Zara, in her Centaurian uniform, grinned in triumph.
I knew it! I knew we would catch you conspiring with Downworlders.
Gwyn raised an eyebrow.
There is only one Downworlder here.
Zara ignored him.
I expected no better of you, Diana Rayburn, but Consul Penhallow? Violating the cold peace in your own homeland? How could you?
Gia held her curved dao across her chest.
Spare me the dramatics, Zara, she said in clipped tones. You don't understand what's happening, and your tantrums cause nothing but trouble.
We're not conspiring with fairies, Zara, Diana said.
Zara spat on the ground. It was a startling gesture in its savage contempt.
How dare you deny that you were conspiring with them when we caught you red-handed?
Zara.
Don't bother, Gia said to Diana. She and the cohort won't listen to you.
They only hear what they want to hear. They accept nothing that contradicts the beliefs they already hold.
Zara turned to her followers.
Take them into custody, she said. We will bring them to the guard. Gwyn threw his axe. It was a gesture so sudden that Diana leapt back in surprise. The axe sailed over the heads of the cohort and slammed into the trunk of an oak tree. Several members of the cohort screamed as the tree crashed over with a deafening roar of snapping branches and shattering earth. Gwyn extended his hand, and the axe flew back into his grip. He bared his teeth at the cowering shadow hunters.
Stay back, or I shall cut you to pieces.
See? Zara had fallen to her knees when the tree had collapsed. She struggled up now, clutching Cortana tightly. See? A conspiracy! We must fight! Anoush! But Anoush had fled into the bushes. The others, visibly shaken, reluctantly grouped around Zara as she took several determined steps toward Gwyn.
What will he do? Gia said in a quiet voice. He will kill them all. He's the Wild Hunt's leader. They are nothing to him.
They are children, Gia said.
Poor Anoush fled. He is only 16. Diana hesitated. They were only children, hateful children, but Gwyn could not strike them down. It was no solution. She ran to him, heedless of what the cohort would think, and spoke into his ear.
Leave us, she whispered, please. They will take us to the guard, but it will not be for long. You must go after Emma and Julian.
Gwyn turned to her, concern plain on his face. But you...
Find them for me, Diana said. I will be safe.
She whistled.
Orion!
Orion cantered into the clearing, cutting between the cohort and Gwyn. Gwyn clambered onto his horse's back and leapt down to kiss Diana, holding her face in his hands for a long moment.
Be safe, he said, and Orion lifted into the sky.
The cohort were all shouting. Most had never seen anything like a steed of the Wild Hunt before.
They really were children, Diana thought wearily. They still had wonder in them, mixed with their ignorance and hate. And she could not hurt children.
She stood quietly beside Gia as Zara and Timothy relieved them of their weapons and chained their hands behind their backs. With their invisibility potions gone, Emma and Julian had to rely on staying in the shadows, hoods up, as they crept along the corridors of the tower. Luckily, it seemed as if everyone had been summoned to some kind of event. The crowds had thinned out, and there were fewer unseelie fae hurrying to and fro along the corridors. The guards seemed distracted as well, and no one questioned them as they slipped around the turn of a corridor and found themselves in front of a hanging tapestry with its pattern of stars. Emma glanced around, concerned. The guards are gone. The corridor was, in fact, empty. Emma's nerves tingled. Something wasn't right.
Good, said Julian. Maybe they took a break or something.
I don't like it, Emma said. They wouldn't leave Ash unguarded.
The guards might be inside the room.
This doesn't feel right.
Someone's coming.
Indeed, there were footsteps in the distance. Julian's face was tight with tension.
Emma, we have to move.
Against her better judgment, Emma drew a short sword from her belt and slipped past the tapestry after Julian. The room beyond was silent, eerily so, and empty of guards. Emma's first impression was of a place both richly decorated and very cold. A large four-poster bed carved of a single massive piece of wood dominated the space. Tapestries hung from the walls, depicting exquisite scenes of natural beauty and fairy. Forests wreathed in mist, tumbling glacial waterfalls, wildflowers growing on cliffs above the sea. Emma could not help but think about the blight. The tapestries were stunning, a loving ode to the beauty of fairy. But outside these walls, the true lands of Unseelie were being consumed by the blight. Had the king decorated this space? Did he see the irony of it? Julian had placed himself by the tapestry door, his sword unsheathed. He was looking around curiously. It was hard not to notice the clothes strewn everywhere. Apparently Ash, like most teenage boys, was something of a slob. A window had been wedged open and cold air drifted through. Ash's golden crown had been dumped on the windowsill, almost as if he were daring a magpie to steal it. Emma crept over to the bed where Ash lay, a still figure under a richly embroidered coverlet. His eyes were closed, perfect half-circles fringed with silvery lashes. He looked innocent, angelic. Emma's heart went out to him, surprising considering his resemblance to Sebastian. But it wasn't an exact duplication, she saw, stepping closer so that her shadow fell over the bed. "He looks a little like Clary," she whispered. "It doesn't matter what he looks like," Julian said. "He's Sebastian's son." "He's a child," she wanted to protest, but she knew it wouldn't matter. She reached out to place a tentative hand on the boy's shoulder. As she did, she saw that there was a wide scar on the side of Ash's throat, no longer hidden by the collar of his shirt, in the shape of an X. There were odd markings on the wall behind his bed, too. They looked like runes, but twisted and sinister ones, like the ones the Indarkand had worn. A ferocious desire to protect him rose up in her, startling in both its strength and its complete lack of logic. She didn't even know this boy, she thought, but she couldn't stop herself from reaching over to shake him gently. "Ash," she whispered. "Ash, wake up. We're here to rescue you." His eyes flew open, and she truly saw Clary in him then. They were the same color green as hers. They fixed on Emma as he sat up, reaching out a hand. They were steady and clear, and a thought flashed through her head. He could be a true leader, not like Sebastian, but like Sebastian should have been. Across the room, Julian was shaking his head. "Emma, no," he said. "What are you?" Ash jerked his hand back and shouted,
"Ethna, Alehead, Rogers, help me."
Julian whirled toward the door, but the two riders had already torn through the tapestry. The bronze armor shone like blinding sunlight. Julian struck out with his blade, slashing it across the front of Aohade's chest, but the rider pivoted away. Ethna's metallic hair flew around her as she launched herself at Julian with a scream of rage. He raised his sword but wasn't fast enough. She crashed into him, seizing Julian and smashing him up against the wall. Ash rolled away across the coverlet. Emma seized him and yanked him back, her fingers sinking into his shoulder. She felt as if she'd emerged from a fog, dizzy, breathless, and suddenly very, very angry.
"Stop!" she shouted. "Let Julian go or I'll cut the prince's throat."
Ethna looked up with a snarl. She was standing over Julian, her blade out. He was crouched with his back against the wall, a trickle of blood running from his temple. His eyes were watchful.
"Don't be a fool," said Aokade. "Do you not understand your only chance to live is letting the prince go?"
Emma pressed the blade closer against Ash's throat. He was like a taut wire in her grip. "Protect Ash," whispered a voice in the back of her head. "Ash is what matters." She bit down on her lip, the pain whiting out the voice in her head. "Explain yourself, Ryder."
"We are in the tower," said Ethna in a tone of disgust. "We cannot slay you without the king's permission. He would be angered. But if you were threatening Ash,"
her look was hungry,
"then we would have no choice but to protect him."
Julian wiped blood from his face. "She's right. They can't kill us. Let Ash go, Emma." Ash was looking fixedly at Julian.
"You look like her," he said with surprise.
Puzzled, Emma hesitated, and Ash took the opportunity to sink his teeth into her hand. She yelled and let go of him. A circle of bleeding dents marked the curve of her thumb and forefinger.
"Why?"
she demanded. "You're a prisoner here. Don't you want to leave?" Ash was crouched on the bed, an odd, feral scowl on his face. He was fully dressed in breeches, a linen tunic, and boots. "In Alicante, I would have been the son of your most hated enemy. You would take me away to my death."
"It isn't like that,"
Emma began, but she didn't finish. Her head flew back as Ethna delivered a stinging slap to her cheek.
"Cease your yammering,"
said Aohade.
Emma turned back once to look at Ash as she and Julian were marched from the room at sword point. He stood in the middle of the chamber, looking after them. His face was blank, without Sebastian's haughtiness and cruelty, but without Clary's kindness either. He looked like someone who had pulled off a successful chess move. Neither Julian nor Emma spoke as they were marched along the corridors. The fey folk around them murmuring and staring. The corridors gave way soon to danker and danker hallways, angling more steeply down. As the light dimmed, Emma caught a brief look at the expression of frustration and bitterness on Julian's face, before the shadows clustered and she could see only moving shapes in the occasional weak illumination of green bow torches hanging on the walls.
"It seems almost a pity," said Eohaid, breaking the silence as they reached a long serpentine hall that led to a dark hole in a distant wall.
Emma could see the glimmer of guard uniforms even in the dark.
"To kill these two before they can witness the destruction of the Nephilim."
"Nonsense," said Ethna curtly.
"Blood for blood. They murdered our brother. Perhaps the king will let us swing the scythe that ends them."
They had reached a hole in the far wall. It was a doorway without a door, cut into a thick wall of stone. The guards on either side seemed intrigued.
"More prisoners," said the one on the left, who was lounging atop a massive wooden chest.
"Captives of the king," said Ethna in a clipped voice.
"Practically a party," said the guard and chuckled. "Not that they stay long, mind."
Ethna rolled her eyes and hustled Emma forward with a prick of the sword between her shoulder blades. She and Julian were ushered into a wide square room with rough-hewn stone walls. Vines grew from the ceiling, ribboning down to plunge into the hard-packed dirt floor. They wove closely together into the shape of boxes. Cells, Emma realized. Cells whose walls were made out of thorny vines, hard as flexible iron. She remembered those thorns stabbing into her and shuddered. Ethna laughed unpleasantly.
"Shiver all you want," she said. "There is no escape here, and no pity."
She took Emma's weapons belt from her waist and forced her to remove the Clave's gold medallion from her throat. Emma cast Julian a panicked look. Nothing would prevent them from suffering the time slippage in Faerie now. Furious, Emma was shoved into a cell through a gap in the vines. To her relief, Julian followed a moment later. She had been afraid they would be separated, and that she would go out of her mind alone. He was also weaponless. He turned to glare at the guards as Ethna tapped the end of her sword against the cage. The vines that had parted quickly slithered and twisted together, closing up any possibility of an exit. Ethna was grinning. The look of triumph on her face made Emma's stomach twist acidly.
"Little shadow hunters," she crooned. "What does all your angel blood avail you now?"
"Come, sister," said Eohaid,
though he was smiling indulgently.
"The king awaits."
Ethna spat on the ground before turning to follow her brother. Their footsteps faded away, and there was darkness and silence. Cold, pressuring silence. Only a little dim illumination came from smoky torches high up on the walls. The strength left Emma's limbs like water pouring out of a broken dam. She sank to the ground in the center of the cage, cringing away from the thorns all around her.
"Julian," she whispered, "what are we going to do?"
He dropped to his knees. She could see where goosebumps had risen all over his skin. The bloody bandage around his wrist seemed to glow like a phantom in the dark.
"I got us in here," he said. "I'll get us out."
Emma opened her mouth.